Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM in Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM in Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM in Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM in Albany. But we are broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, kind of, but on my couch. And I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Today we have, Mark Dunley speaks with Tina Lieberman of Capital District Community Energy about community choice aggregation. Then on Health Watch, Livonia Mallory brings us a special rebroadcast of her conversation with Dr. Sista about pulmonary embolism in memory of her brother, Guy Mallory. After that, Eileen Javier asks Steve Pierce and Brandon Miller about the beginnings of the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Then on Upstate Housing, Michelle Masurgeon speaks with Steve Longo, Executive Director of Albany Public Housing, about how CARES funding is helping families who have lost their income during COVID-19. And to close out the show, Andrea Cunliffe brings us coverage of Congressman Paul Tonko's press conference on the HEROES Act, meant to support frontline workers in New York's Capital Region and beyond. But first, here are the headlines.
The coronavirus has prompted almost two-thirds of American believers of all faiths to feel that God is telling humanity to change how it lives, a new poll finds. The poll by the University of Chicago Divinity School and the Associated Press NOR Center for Public Affairs Research indicates that people may also be searching for a deeper meaning in the devastating outbreak.
Shuttered sectors of New York's upstate economy will begin inching back to life Friday, with more construction, manufacturing, and curbside retail pickups allowed in parts of the state miles away from pandemic-stricken New York City. The smaller cities and rural regions of upstate New York have been spared the brunt of the coronavirus outbreak. Governor Andrew Cuomo is allowing those areas to gradually reopen first, industry by industry. Also, Governor Cuomo says beaches will open for Memorial Day weekend, with social distancing restrictions in place.
The Troy City Council President Carmela Mantello said that she and other Republican members of the council will seek to provide relief to local businesses by repealing the plastic law passed last year that includes a 5-cent fee on paper bags to complement the statewide ban on plastic bags. It is unclear, however, how such a repeal would save businesses any money since paper bags cost money to provide. The proposal at best would save most Troy residents less than a dollar per month nationwide. The COVID-19 crisis has been used to undermine solid waste recycling and composting efforts, starting with the plastic industry seeking to reverse the halt on single-use plastics.
The Times Union reports that two engineering students at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute are suing the Troy University over tuition and fees paid the spring and summer semesters that were moved online due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The lawsuit notes that the in-person experience is so critical that RPI requires first-year students to live on campus. The Albany law firm representing the RPI students is also looking into claims against the Sage Colleges, Skidmore Colleges, Vassar College, Hamilton College, and the University at Rochester.
Matthew Topolowski, the attorney challenging District Attorney David Soares in the Democratic primary, is calling for the two men to debate at least once before the June 23rd primary. He recently called for a restorative justice campaign, a program Soares claims already exists.
Governor Cuomo issued an executive order Thursday evening that extends New York on pause for some areas, including the Capital Region, until at least May 28th. However, regions that have not yet hit the state's metrics to begin reopening could begin that process once they have reached the required goals.
A dozen Schenectady County Corrections officers at the county jail and three sheriff's deputies recently tested positive for the coronavirus. The Times Union reports the department did not carry out any contact tracing, which is the process of identifying persons who may have come into contact with an infected person and collect more information about these contacts.
The Daily Gazette reports that the seven county capital region, 76,297 people have filed for unemployment insurance since mid-March. The official unemployment rate is above 20% in several area counties. Statewide, the unemployment rate is around 25%, with more than 2 million unemployment cases filed since the lockdown. More than 330,000 New Yorkers were approved for the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which provides benefits to gig workers, contractors, the self-employed, and others who don't qualify for traditional unemployment benefits.
The Hannaford supermarket chain announced Thursday that it is looking to hire another 2,000 people across its five-state service area, in addition to the 2,200 new employees the chain announced it would hire in March. Company officials cited both increased demand for its Hannaford To-Go curbside pickup program and rigorous cleaning procedures as the reasons behind the latest round of hiring. Chainwide, Hannaford employs more than 27,000 people.
Ilium Cafe announced Wednesday that it is closing its Troy location on Monument Square due to the pandemic. Its other two stores in the Capital Region will remain open.
On Friday, Governor Cuomo announced that he will not implement the 20% cut to New York State budget he has been saying are possible. Cuomo says he is confident Washington will come through with the funding the state needs to prevent those cuts. Guy, I think we need sound effects after headlines. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasting from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Livonia Mallory, and I'm looking for that sound effect guy.
If anyone's interested in providing sound effects, please give us a call.
Please.
I'm Guy Schaefer. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or sound effects you want to offer, send an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. That's hmm@mediasanctuary.org. 13 municipalities in the Capital District have agreed to create community choice aggregation to purchase electricity for residents collectively, with a goal of lowering the cost for clean energy. While the CCA was planning to issue a request for proposals for electric bids, their plans are on hold due to the COVID-19 crisis and the recent collapse of fossil fuel prices. We talk with Tina Lieberman of Capital District Community Energy, with Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Tina Lieberman, who is with the Capital District Community Energy, and she's been one of the main organizers that's helped bring together about 13 municipalities here in the Capital District to support community choice aggregation to buy electricity together and hopefully get lower prices to go to, you know, clean renewable energy. But, you know, like many other things, the COVID-19 crisis has sort of put a halt to what's going on. But Tina, why don't you just start off with a sort of brief introduction? You know, what is a CCA?
Right. So CCA stands for Community Choice Aggregation. It's a program authorized by the Public Service Commission. Basically, when the utilities were deregulated, people were able to choose who their electricity and gas supplier would be. That worked great for big corporate buyers and municipal buyers because they had a lot of usage, so they could get a good price, a good bulk price. But for people, for individuals like you and me, it wasn't such a good thing because everyone was knocking on our door trying to sell us a product, and every product they tried to sell us cost more and more and more. So we never benefited from that deregulation. So the Public Service Commission saw that, and they saw those predatory energy supply companies and what they were doing to people, charging them like three times or more the regular like National Grid utility company rate. And they came up with this program, community choice aggregation, where now people like you and me, we can get together. Our municipality can get together with other municipalities on our behalf, and we become this large bulk buyers club for our electricity. And so we get a good price. Now, the beauty of this is we can get a good price for the the brown standard mix, which, well, who needs that? Or we can get a really good bulk price, competitive price for a green energy supply, hopefully 100% green energy supply, which would be, you know, it could be some solar, it could be some wind, but it's probably mostly going to be hydropower, because that would be the cheapest renewable energy supply we could tap into.
Now, understand that, 13 communities had joined together, the three big cities, Saratoga Springs also joined, but Schenectady, Troy, and Albany. And, you know, what were some of the other municipalities that came together to move forward with this?
So 13 total. So there's Bethlehem, there's New Scotland, Voorheesville, Niskayuna, Watervliet, Glens Falls, Saratoga. I'm trying to see if I covered the majority of them. And of course, Albany and Troy and Schenectady, as you mentioned.
Right.
So I think that gives you a sense, 13 in all.
Now, you know, recently, so the idea, these communities had come together, the local governments had approved it, and they had hired or chosen this firm, Mega, to go out and handle a request for proposals to get bids from different companies to supply the electricity. But, you know, recently, because of the COVID-19 crisis and also the same time the collapse in energy prices or fossil fuel prices, at least when literally oil companies were having to start to pay people to take the oil off their hand. Understand that the CCA has sort of been put on a hiatus or suspension for a moment. Can you explain what that means and when do they hope to reboot or move forward?
So right now it's true. Energy prices are very volatile. You know, basically they've crashed. They could even crash further. So we don't know. So it's when you have this kind of market volatility in fossil fuel prices, it's not a good time to go out and try to get a 2-year or 3-year contract with a set fixed rate. So we're going to wait till some of this volatility passes. And what Mega is doing, which I think is very wise, there are administrators, they're going to ask these energy supply companies that they typically go to give them some projected rates right now. What do they think the rates would look like for a contract, let's say in October, November, December? They're going to get a bunch of rates. They're going to be looking at rates for 100% renewable energy. They're going to be looking for rates for a higher amount of renewable energy that beats the trailing average price of national grid rate in our area. So they're going to be getting some information, and then they're going to come back to the 13 municipalities in early June, and they're going to share that information with us and tell us what they think when it might be a good time for us to go out to bid. And you have to remember, there's like a 4-month window. So like when they actually put out the request for proposals, it takes a month for that to get back. Then a decision has to be made by the municipalities. Then there's further education of the people in the community. So it's a process.
So they're going to hopefully look at these things in June, but, you know, realistically, you know, in terms of, you know, say you're a resident of Albany or Troy, you know, perhaps the beginning of next year, we might actually see a CCA. And actually for most people, will they really see much difference other than hopefully in their monthly utility bill? In other words, the purpose of the CCA is try to lower the utility bill. But in terms of you know, have a problem with your utility company receiving electricity, you know, how does the average person, you know, how does their world change?
Right. So, you know, I mean, as far as rate, that's where we're going to try to keep it, you know, the same or better of what you're paying now. But as far as the rest of it, like the fact that National Grid services your lines and delivers your electricity, and if you have an outage, who you're going to call is National Grid, that all stays the same. So if you look at your electricity bill, there's two parts. There's the supply part. That's the part that we're allowed to choose who we want to supply our electricity. And then there's a delivery part. That's the part that right now it has to be National Grid. You don't get to choose that.
So what can, you know, you know, people do at this point, and if they want to join this effort, is a way to do so. I imagine you have a Facebook page or a web page.
Yes, we do. We have a Facebook page, Capital District Community Energy, and our web page is all one word, CapitalDistrictCommunityEnergy.com. So yes, we'd absolutely love for you to volunteer with us to keep pursuing community choice aggregation. We'd like to grow our aggregation. We can grow past 13. We can. We'd like to add more and more communities onto it until we've saturated, you know, the 4 to 8 county area. Also, there is something people can do now too to move on to affordable green energy. So I'd love to share that. That's okay.
Sure, go right ahead. And
yeah,
90 seconds.
90 seconds. Community solar and solar for all, which is basically community solar. Also, definitely people should check out. Keep your national grid for now. Don't take on a predatory ESCO unless you're sure they're not going to raise rates or charge you money to leave. But for now, you can get a guaranteed 10% off your rate, your national grid rate right now by joining up with a community solar farm. You could be a renter. You don't need to have solar panels on your roof, nothing like that. Go to Solarize Albany's website, solarizealbany.org. Sign up for community solar there. Or if you're income eligible, you can go to Solar for All. It's part of the NYSERDA website and sign up there. They'll save even more than 10%, and your energy will be entirely green.
Well, we want to thank Tina Lieberman from the Capital District Community Energy for giving us update on, a temporary halt in the development of community choice aggregation here in the Capital District. It does exist in other parts of the state and certainly other states like California, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network speaking to Tina Lieberman, the Capital District Community of Capital District Community Energy. You can reach them at megacca.org.
Next on Health Watch, Livonia Mallory finishes up her conversation about pulmonary embolism with Dr. Akhilesh Sista of NYU. Dr. Sista is the section chief of vascular and interventional radiology at NYU Langone School of Medicine in Manhattan, New York. This is a rebroadcast in memory of Livonia's brother, Guy Mallory, who died of a pulmonary embolism 2 years ago this week.
This is Livonia Mallory of 105.3 FM, the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Once again, we have another segment of Health Watch. I'm right here in the studios with a very special guest. I'm here with Dr. Sista. He's been on our show multiple times, but we have the pleasure of having him right here in Troy, New York, in the studio with us to talk about PEs. Doc, welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much, Livonia. Great to be here.
So listen, tell my listeners again, what is a PE and what brings you to the Capital District?
So a PE, or a pulmonary embolism, is a blood clot in the lungs. What I mean by that is it's a blood clot that lodges in the artery that goes from the right side of the heart to the lungs, so the main blood supply to the lungs. Usually this clot originates in the legs and breaks off and travels all the way up to the lungs. It's a problem because once you get a blood clot in your lungs, it could affect your ability to get blood out to the rest of your body. And also it can cause problems with breathing. And unfortunately, it can be fatal.
So what brings you to the Capital District?
Well, I had the pleasure this morning of giving grand rounds to the medicine department. And I had a chance to visit with the Pulmonary Critical Care Division and visit their doctors. And we talked a lot about different ways to handle this very difficult disease, all the challenges we face, the decisions we have to make, the patient side of it, hearing their perspective and learning from them as well, and sharing our stories. And that's what brought me here. And it was all in honor of of Guy Mallory, your brother, Livonia, who is sort of the face of this disease for us as physicians. He represents what we're all trying to accomplish with this, which is to really improve outcomes for people with PE.
Well, you know, I thank you so much for taking the time to come up to the Capital District. You know, you're a very accomplished physician, but it's also the ability to connect with people that's so invaluable as a physician. Your ability to connect with me and to communicate compassion about the loss of a loved one, that is something that's intangible. And I think it's the one thing that separates one skilled physician from another skilled physician. It's the compassion and the ability to be able to connect with people. But tell my listeners, then, what are some of the symptoms that a person would have that they need to be concerned about, that maybe I'm having a PE?
Lavonia, thank you for your kind words, first of all. So this is a really important question. I think the whole, we've done a great job letting people know what the symptoms are of a stroke, of a heart attack. Maybe not so much for pulmonary embolism. And we have to keep in mind it's the third leading cardiovascular killer after stroke and heart attack. So it's something we need to be aware of. The symptoms may not be that specific. You might have a little bit of shortness of breath. You might have heart palpitations. You might have some chest pain. You might have a cough. You could cough up a little bit of blood. It could be associated with a swollen leg where the clot originated from. So these are things that, if they're not normal, if they're not part of, you know, your medical history, let's say you are usually normal and then all of a sudden you have this set of symptoms, it's something to pay attention to and seek medical attention immediately and make sure that, you know, this is something that, if you're aware of it, that you discuss with your physician.
Mm-hmm. What's some of the research that you're working on right now?
I'm an interventional radiologist, which is a fancy word for image-guided surgery. So I'm a minimally invasive surgeon, and I sort of use catheters and wires to get to places that you'd otherwise have to use open surgery to get to. And so it's very innovative and it's very leading edge sort of medicine, but that means that there's an evidence base that needs to be generated to make this a more viable option. And so there is a lot of controversy about how we treat a subset of PE patients. That controversy can be solved with a clinical trial. So my main research endeavor right now is to get a large clinical trial off the ground, which compares patients who just get blood thinners versus those who get blood thinners plus a catheter-based therapy to remove clot. It would seem that that would be the right thing to do, to get rid of as much clot as possible. But we don't know if it's the right thing to do, if it's safe, it's effective, and makes a difference in people's outcomes at this point. Mm-hmm. So that's my main goal in the next 2 to 5 years, is to get that study off the ground.
Now, you and I were talking earlier about your skill set and what you actually do, and you jokingly describe yourself as a plumber, right? But a plumber for the human body. And as you were showing some pictures in your earlier talk, I thought about, you know, the body is a closed environment, and you are making a small incision in the body in order to get into those veins and arteries and figure out where this clot is. It's sort of like having a blockage in your toilet or your tub. That's what I always think about. And that's the worst thing, right? But you're like the Drano man, okay? For lack of a better word, for the body. And it takes skill. You need a good plumber if you're going to go in there and, you know, Drano something. You know, you need a good plumber, and you're a good plumber. What sort of skills do you really need to have in terms of hand-eye coordination? I mean, what is the one thing that makes you different from the next interventional radiologist?
Well, I can't claim to be, most skilled interventional radiologist out there. I think the plumber analogy is very true. I have to give credit to Dr. Bob Curlin out at UCSF, the former chief of interventional radiology, who is probably one of the best interventional radiologists in the country, if not the world. I think maybe I can speak to what I think a good interventional radiologist is. He or she is a combination of having procedural skill, having medical knowledge, and being a good radiologist. So recognizing what is wrong with an image or where an image creates a roadmap, a guide to get to from point A to point B. And being able to recognize how to do that best is a combination of experience, tactile feel, interpreting images and understanding the medical context of what you're trying to do. So I think when you put all of those together and you can do it effectively and you can do it in the right person at the right time, then that's what makes a great interventional radiologist.
Well, Dr. Sister, I thank you so much for taking the time to join us on WOOC 105.3 FM, the Sanctuary for Independent Media. This has been another episode of Health Watch.
So that was in memory of my brother who passed away 2 years ago. And as we deal with COVID, I say hashtag crush COVID today so we can begin to take control over our own bodies and our own health.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Livonia Mallory, and you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM in Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM in Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM in Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM in Albany. But I'm still coming from my couch, and I'm broadcasting for the Sanctuary of Independent Media. What about you, Guy?
Coming from my bedroom, but for the sanctuary. If you'd like to learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, or if you'd like to provide us with sound effects for any part of the show, please text us at 518-888-3004. That's 518-888-3004. Up next, Eileen Javier speaks with Steve Pierce and Brandon Miller about the beginnings of the Sanctuary for Independent Media. They talk about the sanctuary's different initiatives and projects and the importance of independent media and local news at this time. COVID-19 has brought up challenges to the gatherings in the sanctuary, and to continue their mission to host events, workshops, and film screenings, they have moved into a virtual world.
For people that might not know, what is the Sanctuary for Independent Media? It's an old church, but it was repurposed into a telecommunications production facility. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of different things. It's different things to different people. As you mentioned, it's an old church. That's why we call it the sanctuary. But instead of it being a sanctuary for organized religion, it's a sanctuary for independent media. And the goal is to present all different kinds of points of view and stories and music and film and culture. And the longer we've been here, the more we've gotten into more community organizing, and we're getting ready to open an environmental education center. So it's a lot of different things based in North Central Troy.
And why you chose Troy?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. People are doing things like this all around the world. It's a little different everywhere you go based on what the resources are that people have. We're out of a movement called the Indie Media Movement, which was very popular, successful in the early 2000s as an outgrowth of the movement against corporate globalization. Kind of started with the battle for Seattle, the protests against the WTO there, but it was built on decades of organizing around community-based radio and community journalism and public access television. We chose Troy because, well, we were in Troy and we wanted to do something close to home. And we chose North Troy. We actually originally were meeting at the YWCA in downtown Troy and had met in other places and ended up in North Troy because a friend of ours owned the building that we're in now. And he thought it'd be a perfect place for us, and we went there and started doing our work there, and after doing that for a little while, we agreed and ended up buying the building from him, and now we have a pretty long-term commitment to North Troy.
Okay. We were a group of probably between 12 and 30 individuals at any given time who were all deeply dedicated to independent media. And we would gather and we would work on anti-war videos and media, creating media that would give independent voice to people who are least represented in the media. So that was the group of people, a collective group, who then went from our place at the YWCA and moved into North Troy, where we felt maybe there's a need for more than just producing independent media. Maybe a place where you could come to see all kinds of independent art and cultural activities. Maybe that is really needed too. And from that, the Sanctuary for Independent Media media grew.
How the different initiatives came along? What came in first?
Well, we started just wanting a place to work. The Hudson Mohawk Independent Media Center, which was the roots of the Sanctuary for Independent Media, part of the Indian Media Movement. We were doing a lot of production around, mostly video production, around the anti-corporate globalization movement. And when it really got to be big was in the run-up to the Gulf War. And there was a lot of misinformation and propaganda in the corporate media and even on National Public Radio and public media about the build-up to war. And so we, as a group, were committed to putting out a different narrative about the rush to war. And we put out a number of videos, and particularly one, Independent Media in a Time of War, which was a documentary about Amy Goodman's speech on the subject. Got a national and international audience. And we were able to sell copies of the DVDs that we made. And with the money, we needed to find a new place to work because of changes at the YWCA. And so we ended up moving to the Sanctuary for Independent Media. That's what we ended up calling it. It was a place that we needed as a workspace to put our editing equipment. And we thought we would just use the upstairs of the space for events and things to help raise money to pay the rent. And we had editing facilities downstairs. And so we really started out as a presenting space. We showed movies, we had music, we had speakers. And the idea was just to raise money to keep the organization going. And over time, it's evolved into many different things. And Brenda's been a driver of a lot of them. So I'll let her talk about that.
Well, I remember there was one day where I was planting a shrub in front of the sanctuary, and I realized that as my hands were in the ground, everybody walking by talked to me and said, "Hi, how wonderful." And we started really connecting more and more to the block that we are in North Troy between Glen and 101st, which really was filled with abandoned buildings and empty lots. So we grew from our space in the sanctuary, our nature lab mission, which stands for North Troy Art, Technology, and Urban Research in Ecology. Many of us were and are still deeply dedicated to environmental issues and issues of striving for sustainability. And so this was an opportunity for us to connect as independent media makers with networks of community organizers who were all coming together to try to make North Troy, Troy, and a more positive environment to live in.
Okay, that's wonderful. And now you have the Collard Greens, the Nature Lab, the radio station, and continue growing. I can't wait for the Nature Lab building to be ready, so I do community outreach.
Right.
And now with the unprecedented times that we're living with COVID-19, what changes will you make to continue facilitating your workshops, the activities at the Sanctuary for Independent Media?
Well, that's a real challenge. I'm going to flip to Brenda to explain what we're going to be doing. But I want to say that one of the things that's kind of ironic is that we're about to celebrate our 15th anniversary in North Troy. And we've spent most of that time building physical spaces where people can get together and share. And as you say, in workshops, events, different kinds of things. So we built a lot of infrastructure. You mentioned the radio station. We have an online TV channel and lots of things on the web. But mostly what we were doing was in person. So COVID has created a challenge for us to pivot to do more of this stuff online. And Brenda's really the one who's been organizing that.
Well, I'd like to give attention first to the radio that everyone is listening to, Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And we feel really blessed to have had 2 years of the development of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Little did we see when we started this how important it would be in the age of COVID. We were dedicated to our mission of reporting local voices, reporting on independent issues that face us in our community. But since COVID, the radio station and the producers like you have absolutely blossomed and taken our magazine to a higher level. Steve, how do you see that radio piece is so critical to us moving forward in the age of COVID?
Well, I'd say, first of all, it's not just radio. It's a kind of a more of a multimedia approach now, where we're embracing the web as much as we can and getting out in podcasts and streaming. And but of course, one of the things that sets us apart, since a lot of people are doing that, we do have a broadcast too. You can listen to WOOC 105.3 FM in Albany and Troy, and also our programming is heard on other stations throughout the region. But the problem that we're confronted with is that because people can't meet, they're not able to get information that way. way. And when they're looking for information, it's hard to find from a source that is journalistic. And that's because of the collapse of the commercial media, which has been going on for a long time, really ever since the web. But even before that, there was corporate consolidation and other factors that made corporate media, mainstream media, less and less reliable and less local. Because when the corporate ownership looks to save money, they get rid of people, and the people they get rid of are the people who are local on the ground. So we saw years ago, there was a huge hole in the capital region media environment, as there is almost everywhere in this country, in local journalism. And so we thought, okay, we're going to fill that hole. We're going to train ourselves to be journalists, and we're going to go to where the people are and where the stories are, and we're going to report. And so the COVID story is just, you know, the biggest story ever in that regard, but we remain committed to that goal. And the challenge for us is doing it in an environment where you can't meet with people personally. And I think we've done a great job of, not all of us have done a great job, learning the technology and figuring out how this can be done online and using online tools.
So we're going to continue working remotely. That's what you're saying. And then doing some other outlets of creative work to outreach and reach the people that are expecting for the Sanctuary for Independent Media to continue providing that work and that space, even if it's through this outlet for now.
Yes, we are working with students from Troy Prep doing radio production. We're doing science and arts education with students from Troy Middle School, all virtually. And we are shifting some of our events to virtual events, films. We're featuring our Health Autonomy Clinic, of which you've been also a vital part. Really trying to continue our mission in this time and strategizing every day how we can remain sustainable and a resource for this community and for our continued growth.
Okay, and where can people find information on all the initiatives, and also if anybody would like to do an internship at the Sanctuary for Independent Media?
Well, folks can go to mediasanctuary.org and find all of that there. You might have to hunt around a little bit. We have a good search function on the website, but if you're interested in an internship, I think if you go to About Us or How to Get Involved, you can find out that. We have a lot of really great interns, and it's a great way to get involved and to get credit while you're doing it. And you'll find out about all the different initiatives. You'll find a link to our online stream of radio programming, and also our video stream, and links to our large online collection of videos that goes back 15 years, hundreds of hours of videos. So lots to look at there. So MediaSanctuary.org.
Okay, perfect. Brendan Steves, when is the 15-year celebration?
It's this fall. I think it's in October. I'd have to look at this exact date. I know the first event that we had was a theater production called Marks and Soho, which we did two performances of, but we moved into the building and were using it for our own purposes for, you know, a few weeks before that, cleaning it up and getting organized. So fall of 2020 is our 15th anniversary, though.
Okay.
I remember it was leaking from the roof, and people were sitting in the audience with umbrellas over their heads.
Yep. Well, we have to plan something. Definitely. We still have time. Hopefully everything changes and goes back to normal. Yes. Thank you so much for giving me the time today, and looking forward to seeing you again and giving you a hug. Okay. But for now, from my house and your house, here we are, WOOC 105.3 FM. Thank you, Brendan Steve, today. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. That was Eileen Javier speaking to our very own Steve Pierce and Brandon Miller. For more information about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, you can go to www.mediasanctuary.org, all one word.
Breaking news. Governor Cuomo announced on Friday that he has rejected a key water permit for the Williams Fracked Gas Pipeline in New York Harbor. This decision comes with prejudice, so Williams will not be able to reapply. With 5% of public housing and Section 8 families losing their jobs, and with a backlog of 1,200 non-emergency repairs, Steve Longo, Executive Director of Albany Public Housing, explains how CARES HUD funding is helping families who lost their income, with Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
This is Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, and my guest today is Mr. Steve Longo, Executive Director of the Albany Public Housing Authority. Welcome, Mr. Longo.
Well, thank you very much, Michelle, for having me.
So, Mr. Longo, you manage and direct a large portfolio of public housing and Section 8 voucher landlords. Talk about how COVID-19 has directly impacted the tenants and residents of public housing in Section 8 here in Albany. Specifically, how many families have reported a loss of income, and how do the caseworkers work with the families struggling to pay their rent?
Okay. So what's going on here is that public housing residents and Section 8 residents, there's roughly about 2,400 of each, they can call their caseworker or contact them online as soon as they hear that they've had a loss of income. Now, they can do that anytime. But, of course, we know now with COVID and so many furloughs and layoffs and small businesses closing that it's happening more frequently. So we're geared up to be able to handle the volume. So if you live in public housing, you contact your caseworker, who you already have presumably a relationship with, because you have to go through an annual recertification process, and you tell them right away, I lost my income, or I lost some of my income. So that triggers the caseworker to get going right away to get the income, the rent adjusted. So in the HUD program, you can go down to what is called the HUD minimum rent, which is $50. And then you could say, well, wait a minute, I've got no savings, I've got no income, I haven't got my unemployment yet, I can't pay $50. And so then you can request something called a hardship rent, which you're eligible for 3 months, which is zero. And then you can work with your caseworker to get the zero or the $50 rent in place, and then we can help provide you technical assistance to get any unemployment benefits that you're able to. Once those unemployment benefits kick in, if you're eligible, then the rent would be 30% of the unemployment. And one thing that folks should take notice of is that CARES Act 3 money, the $1,200 or the $2,400 for families and the $600 on top of the unemployment, none of that is allowed to be counted towards your rent. So you don't have to worry about that.
Talk about how the CARES funding has helped cover some of that rent loss. You mentioned you're getting some additional funds for the next couple of months.
In the CARES Act, Congress appropriated 2 months of average public housing subsidy to cover CARES COVID-related expenses. So in our case, it's about $940,000, and we have to make that last to 12/31, according to the legislation. In Section 8, we get money to pay the HAP, which is our share of the rent or the housing assistance payment, and we get admin money. In the CARES Act, we got 2 months of admin money, which is approximately $440,000. And we got that to cover the additional expenses it costs to implement the program through 12/31. We're also getting additional money on an as-needed basis to pay the increase in rent to the private landlords due to the loss of income by their tenants that are on Section 8. I hope that helps, but I do know it's confusing.
You also mentioned previously that you had 1,463 emergency work orders completed since March 11th. Or since March 11th, and 1,163 backlog work orders to be addressed when you open up. How do you see handling, getting a catch up with those backlogs? Because I'm sure people are, you know, trying to make it through. Like you gave me some stories there, that was pretty good about the refrigerator. And then what are your plans for reopening and getting the staff, you know, back into the office and the maintenance folks?
Well, I like to think that we are a lean, mean organization that operates much like a private sector, but sometimes we slog along because we have to deal with all of the different regulations. So it's taken us a little bit of time, but we're really proud of the way that we've converted our whole operation in to comply with social distancing and reducing folks' time in the office. So what we've done there, let's quickly cover that. So all of our offices are closed, and including the big atrium and the public housing headquarters here at 200 South Borough. And so all of the interaction that is being done with everybody on public housing in Section 8, they're calling their caseworker, they're emailing their caseworker, they're texting their caseworker, and then many people have the ability to take a picture of their pay stubs or the other things and send it to us on their phones. But for those that can't, they our maintenance guys put mail slots in all our buildings, and they can drop off their paperwork. And then all of our caseworkers are working remotely from home. They've been given laptops and headphone sets that are tied into our voice over internet phone system. So the caseworker sitting at a laptop from their home, the tenant or the Section 8 voucher holder, it's just business as usual. They can't tell where they're calling from. And if they need to drop off the paperwork, caseworkers are taking turns day by day and coming in and getting that paperwork and scanning it to the different caseworkers. So all that's happening. You can pay your rent online. You can pay your rent. Everybody gets a rent coupon and a self-addressed envelope. So there's multiple ways in this environment to pay your rent. And so all that has been done. And at this point in time, our maintenance folks, they're only the people that work in folks in the apartments. We're only having 50% of those maintenance laborers come in at a time. And they're taking turns, so it's not always the same person. And they're only doing emergency work orders, like, for instance, no heat, no hot water, the kitchen sink or the bathroom sink is plugged. And that could be very unsanitary and viewed as an emergency, as same as a toilet or a refrigerator not functioning. So we have completed, since we started this on March 17th, 1,463 of those emergency work orders. And we have almost 1,200 backlog work orders that we're going to have to do when we get in. And you know, it's not one size fits all. So sometimes, you know, the operator or the who, if you're reporting your work order online, you know, like one thing would be we had a work order for a broken handle on a refrigerator. So that got classified as a regular non-emergency. And then we got a call from, you know, an ombudsman or somebody out there advocating for elderly or and generally folks that need it, to say we had a resident in one of our elderly high rises who was not able to take their meal delivery because they couldn't refrigerate it because they couldn't get into the refrigerator. So immediately we had to get over there, and we didn't understand from the work order that the broken handle prevented him from getting into the refrigerator. So
okay, I'm really sorry, I have to kind of wrap up. So I just have one quick question. How do you see down the road what's going to happen with public housing?
Well, I think that, you know, we were very, very fortunate to get into CARES 3 and to get the money that you and I spoke of. I do think that the money has to be expended by 12/31. I do think that that is easily doable. And I think that as long as, you know, we get to back to some level of normalcy by then, we should be fine. But if not, we're going to need additional funding. And we've been talking to our legislators about that.
Okay. And I apologize, but I'm going to have to end this program. And I thank you, Mr. Longo, for spending your time with me today.
My pleasure, Michelle, and thank you to all your listeners.
And this is Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Michelle Masurgeon speaking to Steve Longo, another good upstate housing segment.
And to close out the show, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Andrea Cunliffe brings us coverage of a video conference with Congressman Paul Tonko, in which he outlines key points of the HEROES Act. The bill delivers major new funding to keep first responders and frontline workers on the job in New York's Capital Region and beyond.
An opportunity here to establish a $200 billion HEROES Fund, which will provide for bonuses for hazard pay because people have really put their lives on the line. There is also an opportunity here to address the hospitals and nursing homes, healthcare facilities, our mental health service providers with a $100 billion fund that will go towards additional relief for those institutions. We have $75 billion that will go toward additional testing, tracing, and treatment, a three-pronged approach that will speak to not only containing the virus, but identifying with requirements for study and reporting that will enable us to see the demographic profiles of where this disease is impacting us in the country and to which population. So a lot of work done here to go forward with efforts that respond to various institutions and organizations, including our Postal Service, which receives an amount of investment here with this bill that will enable them to continue to deliver mail, which also responds to deliveries of medications for many of our shut-ins. So this is an inclusive bill that really responds to, again, our lives and our livelihood. It is keeping us as a nation strong and functioning. And these are essential workers that provide essential services that make our quality of life what we expect it to be. We as Americans are a tough group. We are determined, we are resilient. This responds to the great bravery, the courage, and certainly the resilience that people have shown as we've worked through these several weeks and months combating this pandemic. It is far from over. We hope the testing and the accuracy of contact tracing and treatment will enable us to achieve the final goals of conquering this very, very challenge of our lifetime. This legislation responds with appropriate support to those who have led us through these challenging times, those who have put their lives on the line so that we can enjoy the essential services, receive the essential services we require. So it is about providing assistance to states which provide essential services, to our cities, our counties, our local governments that make our daily activities, our quality of life, what it is. And it's certainly about providing the resources and the guidance, the efforts to assist our hospitals, our nursing homes, and our mental health service providers, those facilities, those healthcare institutions that are in the midst of responding to the individual treatment that is required by far too many.
You mentioned some statistics about the death totals, the case numbers.
Sure. Nearly 87,000 people have succumbed to COVID-19 virus, and some 1.4 plus million cases have been determined. And so it tells us those numbers are staggering, and it continues to challenge us as we, as a nation, respond to this pandemic.
Thank you, Congressman. And for those uninitiated, the chimes behind the Congressman are known as the Capitol bells, and they signal that votes are upcoming. So, Congressman, do we have just a couple of minutes to take a few questions before?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need to vote shortly, but they're doing it in alphabetical sequence with clustering of members that will hopefully be masked as they go to the floor to vote.
I have a question.
Hey, Dan
Bazile here from Spectrum News. Quick question for you. I understand that Senator Mitch McConnell has been doing the rounds talking about this bill, and he said that we need to take a pause on more of those funds, of those relief packages. So what does that mean for this bill in the Senate?
I think that basically as this is unveiled and when people realize the assistance that's provided, they'll see it as critical and essential. And I think like any development of public policy, I'll reach back to the days of Abraham Lincoln, who always said that this is driven by public sentiment. And I think public sentiment here will challenge our counterparts in the United States Senate to respond accordingly. I think that there will be growing support when people recognize what relief is provided our states and local governments, our hospitals, our nursing homes, our mental health providers. When they see that assistance, when they see the assistance for hazard fund, for those who really embraced enormous amounts of courage, they'll respond favorably. And they'll advance, I think, their support for this legislation. Just as an individual congressman, I have heard from several who work in local government, people who maintain our water and sewer systems, people who are there as caseworkers, providing essential social services for families, healthcare workers, certainly frontline people who have been in the midst of this pandemic, from teachers, from firefighters, from police officers. People have been reaching out to us, understanding that, you know, when we look at state governments, it might look like an accounting ledger, but when you break it down to the human element, it's essential human services, and it's provided by professionals out there who have been really, really heroes, as the act would designate, and they need to be responded to. I would share too with, I think it's an important stat, while this is a major bill that provides resources from many, many perspectives, there is to the local government element a total of $1.3 billion estimated to come into the capital region. And so that relief at the local level translates into continuation of essential services and the relief to potential relief to the property taxpayer.
This is Emily from the Albany Times Union. And I wanted to ask about the funding for childcare in this bill, Congressman. Many House Democrats pushed for $50 billion to support childcare as these businesses have been closed and people rely on them and need them to be able to get back to work through reopening. But I understand that the HEROES Act only includes $7 billion for childcare, and some Democrats expressed disappointment in that. I was wondering if Speaker Pelosi has addressed that in caucus conversations about why only $7 billion was included on that provision, and how you think that sets you up to negotiate on childcare funding with the Senate.
Well, I think you raise an important concept of putting a bill together. You know, I hope my colleagues and I don't reject it for what's not in there, but really respect it for what is in there. I too would like to see much more for childcare because of the reasons you cited, but they try to contain within certain parameters the amounts that we provide for the given elements of the bill. This is not the last iteration, I got to believe. There will be other concepts coming down the road because we are in the midst of a pandemic. And so we will measure what assistance that is provided in this bill will do. And if it falls far short, I am confident that we'll be there with additional funds that will make up for that shortfall. But childcare becomes an essential bit of funding and a resource for working families in this country who are impacted by the need for quality childcare opportunities.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, sir. Andrea, you had a question.
Hello, Congressman. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
This is Andrea Cunliffe from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, WOOC radio station. I'm curious about where we will find the funding for this bill. There's so many things that are needed in this country, and I know we have a financial problem. So how will we be able to fund this bill?
Well, you know, the efforts through all of this pandemic will come to that payment mechanism. And we'll be working for a very progressive formula. Obviously, you know, the efforts in the House have expressed our ideals, our values for America's working families, and that moment will come. But for now, there is no way that we can afford not to do something. This is about keeping the nation afloat. It's about responding to our lives and our livelihoods. And that is the important driving force with this legislation. And the two houses and the two parties on the Hill will make it their job to, in, I hope, a progressive fashion, come together with the payment for what we have here. But right now, the thinking is we cannot afford not to invest in our families.
That was correspondent Andrea Cunliffe's great piece at the Press Advisory Conference with Congressman Paul Tonko discussing the HEROES Act. Guy, guess what?
Is it that time again?
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer, and our engineer tonight is Alexis. Remember to tune back in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.